like, what?
Okay, today we want to start by talking about the phylum-platic helminths. Phylum-platic helminths are sometimes what we call the flatworms. They include organisms such as your free-living flatworms, your flukes, and tapeworms. Okay. These organisms do have triple blast tissue level organization. So this is the first group of organisms that we've talked about that has three tissue layers of organization. These organisms are also acoelomate. So when we talked about whether or not what acoelomate organism was, it was an organism with a body cavity. These organisms have no body cavity. Okay, it's the only phylum that we're going to talk about that is acoelomate or has no body cavity at all. Right? These organisms sometimes, as we mentioned, some of them are parasitic, others of them are not. They're typically bilaterally symmetric with some cephalization, except for in the tapeworms, some of that cephalization is quite reduced. What we're going to do with this phylum is I'm going to talk about the class Turbellaria, which are the free-living flatworms, and then we'll talk about how the other two classes of flatworms differ from the class Turbellaria. Okay? So the class Turbellaria are the free-living flatworms. Typically we find free-living flatworms living in marine environments. There are some freshwater representatives. But you'll find them mainly in intertidal areas, areas between high and low tide, or right near the edges of the oceans. Okay. These organisms are not really large. This is a Turbellarian called Planaria. You might have heard of Planarians before. Usually these organisms are a millimeter to maybe 5 millimeters long, so you know, fairly small organisms. You'll notice, looking at the exterior view of this Planarian, that they do have bilateral symmetry with cephalization. They have this cephalic region here. And when we talk about a head or a cephalic region, remember that we said that the cephalic region is typically where a structure called a brain is found. And we do see a brain in the Turbellarian flatworms. However, it's a very primitive brain. Okay. We know that there's a brain there because there are some sensory structures associated with that cephalic region. We can see some things pointed out here, eye spots, and these structures called auricles. Okay. Now, before we talk about those sensory structures, let's ask the question, what is a brain? Okay, the brain does control motor functions. It interprets sensory information, right? Okay. But what is a brain? It is an organ. What type of organ, though? In other words, okay, it has something to do with the nervous system, right? And really what a brain is, it's a specific group or type of neurons. Okay. They're what we call interneurons. Interneurons are able to receive information, kind of make a decision, and then send more information out, kind of in response to that external stimuli. Okay. Now, the brain of the Turbellarian flatworm is actually very, very primitive. Really, all it is just a very small mass of ganglion. It's nothing like our brain. Okay. In fact, in our body, we have two brains that are actually much larger than pretty much brains in most other organisms. One of them you're all thinking of is where? Inside your head, right? Where's our other huge brain that we have?
Our spine.
Yeah, our spinal cord. Our spinal cord is a much more complex brain than the brain that we'll see in most other animals. Okay? It's a mass of interneurons, and actually it's able to make decisions to some extent and so forth, right? So, very primitive brain in the Turbellarian flatworms. Again, we do see some sensory structures. These eye spots, they don't function like our eyes. Basically, all the eye spots are is they allow the organism to either be positively or negatively phototaxic. What that means is that they essentially just detect light, the presence or absence of light. Okay. To be positively phototaxic means that they can move towards light. Positively means good, right? And phototaxic means specifically, photo means light, taxic means to move. So they can either move positively towards light or negatively away from light. Okay. So these eye spots just simply detect the presence or absence of light. Okay. Any questions about that? The auricles, which are also found in the cephalic region, are chemoreceptors. Okay. And they basically detect chemicals in their environment. Do we have any chemoreceptors in our body?
No.
What'd you say?
Nose.
Yeah, our nose, right? Our nose is a chemoreceptor, much more complex than the auricles. What other sense do we have that is a chemoreceptor sense?
Taste.
Taste, yeah. So we have two different types of chemoreceptors in our body. But simply what the auricle does is it helps to detect chemicals in the water. Most of the turbellarian flatworms are scavengers, and so this chemical sensory structure is very important for them because it helps them to move towards dead and decaying organic material. Now, another characteristic that's kind of a little bit different in the turbellarian flatworms is typically we think of a mouth as being in the cephalic region, right? Because our mouth is found in our cephalic region. And the turbellarian flatworms, their mouth is not found in the cephalic region, but it's found about halfway back on the body. Okay.
Where does it live?
They live in marine environments, generally intertidal areas. Okay. So if we look internally at some of the internal structures of the turbellarian flatworm, the first thing that I want you to notice is the digestive system here. Okay. And with this digestive system, notice the mouth is found here, but again, notice that there's no anus in this digestive tract. A characteristic that they have somewhat in common with the cnidarian organisms is that they have a gastrovascular cavity. So food goes into this gastrovascular cavity, digestion occurs, and then the digestive waste is spit back out of the mouth. Okay. So very similar to the cnidarians in that respect. You'll notice they don't really have any respiratory structures, and that's because they are acoelomate. The way that they respire is by simple diffusion across the outside of the organism and then also through the gastrovascular cavity. Okay? Any questions about that? Now, you'll also notice here in this picture that there are both male and female reproductive structures found in this particular, or in the turbellarian flatworms. And so they both have both male and female reproductive structures in the same organism. These organisms can reproduce sexually, but they can also reproduce asexually by two different means that we talked about. Okay. First of all, let's talk a little bit about how they reproduce sexually. They have both male and female reproductive structures, and they do have copulatory organs. Notice the penis here is in the genital pore, and then there's basically a vagina associated with the female reproductive structures. And so what happens is when these organisms find a mate, they line up opposite one another. So if you can kind of imagine the fingertips of my fingers or the heads of turbellarian flatworms, they line up with their heads pointing in opposite directions. And one way of remembering this is they kind of have double the pleasure, double the fun, right? Okay. What happens is the top worm inserts its penis into the vagina of the bottom worm. The bottom worm inserts its penis into the vagina of the top worm, and they fertilize each other. Okay. So there are really two fertilization events here. Both worms are being fertilized at the same time, and that's how they sexually reproduce. Okay.
Do they fertilize themselves?
Yes. One way that they can asexually reproduce is hermaphroditically. If they can't find a mate, what they'll do is they'll insert their own penis into their own vagina and fertilize themselves. Okay. Any questions about that? Now there's another way in which they can reproduce asexually as well, and that's by budding. Sometimes these turbellarian flatworms, what they'll do is they'll actually start splitting posteriorly here, and they'll just split the organism in half. So they can reproduce sexually, and then there are two ways in which they can reproduce asexually. One is by budding, and the other is by hermaphroditic asexual reproduction. Okay? Any questions about reproduction in these organisms? This is just a picture of the nervous system. Notice the primitive brain found in the cephalic region. And then they have two nerve cords. Now these nerve cords are nothing like our nerve cords, what we would think of as our spinal cord. They're just simple neurons. They don't have any brain function at all. But basically they are here so the information can be passed from the brain to the rest of the body, and so the rest of the body can receive information and pass it to the brain, essentially. Okay. Any questions about their nervous system? So let's just take a look at some planarians or turbellarian flatworms. This is a planaria. You can see the eye spots here. You can't really see the auricles too well in this picture. You can see where the mouth would be right here. This is the pharynx. Okay. You can also see both gastrovascular cavity and reproductive structures. These are the ovaries right here. Okay. And then this back here that you can see the darker spot is the gastrovascular cavity. Okay. Any questions about that? Again, these organisms are very small. Just to kind of give you a reference point on this picture, this is a grain of sand here. Okay. There are a couple of species of terrestrial turbellarian flatworms. We said most of them are marine. This is a terrestrial turbellarian flatworm. The only place where you'll find terrestrial turbellarian flatworms is in tropical rainforests. Okay. They don't really have a protective covering around their body, so if you were to release them into our environment, they would dry out very, very quickly. Okay. Here's another turbellarian flatworm. You can see the eye spots here, the pharynx with the mouth there. Any questions about the turbellarian flatworms? Yeah.
Are they harmful in any way?
Are they what?
Harmful in any way?
Are they harmful to humans? Mm-hmm. Usually not, but they could probably cause some intestinal problems if you were to eat them or drink them, you know, full size.
Is that what a tapeworm is?
No. We'll talk about the tapeworms here in a minute. Okay. They belong to the same phylum. The next class is the class Trematoda. The class Trematoda are what we sometimes call the flukes. Okay. Now the flukes also belong to the phylum Platyhelminths. We're going to talk about how the flukes are different from the turbellaria here in just a minute. But the Trematoda are the flukes. Okay. Now one major difference between the Trematoda and the turbellaria is that the Trematodes or the flukes are all parasitic. Which means what?
Parasites.
Okay, they're parasites, which, what is a parasite?
They feed off a host.
Okay, so they're a smaller organism that feeds off a larger organism, okay? Feeds on a larger organism. These are actually what we call endoparasites. They're found inside of the host's body, typically. Now with flukes, they're actually, another characteristic of flukes, I should say, is that they have a complex life cycle. What does that mean?
Yes.
Okay, they need to live in more than one host in order to complete their life cycle. Okay. Just looking at the flukes here, notice that it has, this is something that shouldn't be there. So kind of ignore that. But notice here in the anterior end, they don't really have sensory structures like eyes or auricles. Like the turbellarian flatworms. Why don't you think they have eyes or auricles?
It's too dark.
Okay, it's too dark? You're close. They don't need them, right? If they're living in a host, like a human, they have basically a homeostatic environment, an environment that doesn't change, and so they don't need really any sensory structures, okay, as adults. Notice here, they do have a digestive system with outgrowths in the digestive system in the gastrovascular cavity, and that's basically to increase surface area for digestion. They have both male and female reproductive structures as well. This is the life cycle of the labels it here as the human liver fluke. Another common name for this particular fluke is the Chinese liver fluke, because mainly you see it in Oriental countries. This particular liver fluke kills over 1 million people every year. Okay, so it is a fairly serious problem in some human populations. Now, typically when flukes are in their terminal host or in their last host, when their flukes are adults, they're typically found in the liver of their host. Okay. Now, most flukes cannot jump from host to host. In other words, most flukes are specific to certain groups of animals. So for example, if you have a fluke that's in a cow, it really probably, most of them cannot be passed to humans. Okay? But it could be passed to other cows or to other cow-like animals, like say for example bison. Does that make sense? There are some flukes that can jump from species to species. We have one around here that's called the sheep liver fluke, that can be in a sheep as a terminal host or a human. Okay, so there are some of those that can jump. Even if you were to eat the fluke without cooking it, eat it raw, typically they don't jump from host to host. Okay, you can actually see flukes in a lot of domesticated and wild animal livers. If you ever get a chance to slaughter an animal, or if you're going hunting and you're gutting an animal, next time you do that, take the liver out and run your hand across the surface of the liver. And sometimes you can feel a little bumps in the liver. If you take your knife really carefully and slit into that little bump, you can actually excise the fluke out of the liver, cut it out of the liver. Okay. But even if you eat them raw, you're probably not going to get the fluke, even if you eat the liver raw. Any of you ever had raw liver before?
I thought that was really dangerous.
Actually, it's not too dangerous. It's really good. If you ever get a chance, you want to eat, try raw liver out of an animal. It has to be warm. Once it gets cold, it's not that good. But the Native Americans and other Native people, raw liver was a delicacy. And I learned why. I've actually tried raw liver from a few different animals. And it's really, really good. It's sweet. It's like candy. Okay. And it kind of dissolves in your mouth. It is. It's really good. You need to try it. Gosh, you got to try everything at least once or twice in life, right? And if you want a little bit tartar taste, you know, a little bit more sour taste, you dip it in the bile and eat it that way. Yeah.
Doesn't the liver like filter the body, like filter everything that goes through the body?
Uh huh.
So why is it sweet? What is it?
Because there's sugars that are filtered out there. Tastes to me like a lot like the texture and everything's kind of like one of those suckers that you get at the store that has the two different layers on it, and you put it in your mouth and it just kind of dissolves. It's kind of how it tastes. Yeah.
What liver would you recommend?
I don't like deer liver as good as elk or buffalo liver.
Human? Technically, you could just shoot an elk and cut it open and take a bite.
Yeah, when it's still warm. You don't want to let it cool off, though. They're not as good once it's cooled down. They kind of harden up, too. Anyways, getting back to the Chinese liver fluke or the human liver fluke. Again, the adults found in the liver. Now, your liver is actually attached to your digestive system. I don't know if you knew this, but basically your liver is attached to your digestive system through ducts that are released that go from the liver into the small intestine. And so when these organisms produce eggs, the eggs actually move through the bile ducts and into the digestive tract. And so they're then in the small intestine. They then move from the small intestine to the low intestine, or the large intestine, excuse me. And then they're released with fecal material. All right. Now, we don't see a lot of human liver flukes or human-like liver flukes in our areas, because we basically have really good sanitation. Most of the time, most of us use sewers, right, for our waste. And so in some parts of the world, however, and this happens a lot in, again, in Asia, much of Asia does not have really good sewage treatment facilities, okay? And so the eggs get into the, are released with the fecal material. If that sewage gets into the water, which is very common, what happens is those larvae are then able to encyst in a snail. The snail is the first intermediate host in the Chinese or human liver fluke, okay? The immature stages of the fluke, or what we call the mericidium, lives inside of the snail and lives off of the snail. Eventually, that snail may be eaten by a fish, or sometimes, in some species, the larval stages will actually swim out of the snail in the Sicaria stage and actually try and find a fish. What they then do is they actually encyst in the muscle of the fish. Okay, and when they're in that form, they're what we sometimes call metasicaria in the muscle of the fish. Now they're actually very, very small, pretty much microscopic. They usually encyst in the muscle along the backbone of the fish, which is, if you eat fish, you know that that's the best part of the fish to eat, right? That's where the most muscle is found, or the most meat. And so they encyst in that muscle. If a human then eats poorly cooked or uncooked fish, that fluke then can be transferred to the human and can then infect the human liver, okay? And eventually it can cause liver failure. Again, that's one reason why it's sometimes called the Chinese liver fluke, because in a lot of the Oriental countries they eat raw fish, right? We've all heard of sushi before, okay? Have any of you eaten sushi? See, you guys, that's gross, man. You guys, raw liver is much better than raw fish, let me tell you, at least in my mind. But every time you eat sushi, you are actually taking a fairly large risk that you're going to get a liver fluke. Okay? Quite a few people, even in the United States, get infected with liver flukes by eating raw fish or sushi. Yeah. If you get infected with the liver fluke, is there anything that you can do to get rid of it? And the answer is remove your liver or remove part of your liver, okay? Which is really not a very good option, okay? So any questions about the flukes? Yeah?
What are the symptoms?
Liver failure, liver problems. Basically, you'll turn kind of yellowish. I don't know if you've ever seen anybody with cirrhosis of the liver before, but their skin kind of turns yellowish. You might have heard of babies that, where their liver doesn't function well right at the first, and are kind of yellowish, the bilirubin levels are low and stuff. Okay.
So it basically always kills the baby?
What's that?
So it would mostly always kill the human?
Does it mostly always kill the human? And the answer is no. But it can cause you problems. And if In all reality, it's probably going to cause death earlier than you would have died, you know. Yeah.
So why wouldn't it go into the fish's liver and not its muscle?
The reason why it doesn't go into the fish's liver is because it's the second intermediate host. It needs to go through those developmental stages before it infects the liver. Okay. It's kind of like, malaria that we talked about. Different hosts have different kind of different functions in the life cycle of the organism. Okay. Go ahead.
Like if someone was swimming where there were a bunch of the, like before they get into the fish, mm-hmm. would they infect the human?
No. No. There has to be a second intermediary host for this particular fish. Yeah.
Well, I mean, like would it go into the muscle like a little fish?
No, probably not.
Yeah. So what happens if the fish isn't eaten?
What happens to the fluke? It basically dies. If the fish isn't eaten, the fluke dies. And so this is one thing that's kind of interesting about parasites. Parasites produce large, large numbers of offspring. For example, a single fluke may produce millions of eggs, hoping that a few of them, maybe three or four, get into snails, right? Or maybe 100 of them get into snails. And from the snail to the fish, maybe 1 out of 100 gets from a snail to a fish. And once they're in a fish, maybe 1 out of 1,000 or 10,000 actually works its way back to a human. So they produce huge numbers of offspring because of that. The problem of getting from one host to another. Yeah.
How come the acids in the stomach don't kill it?
They actually have protective structures. They have a cuticle around their body, kind of like the cuticle of a plant. The most common liver fluke that we have around here, as I mentioned before, is the sheep liver fluke. The sheep liver fluke has a little bit different life cycle than the human liver fluke or Chinese liver fluke. It actually can live either, the terminal host can either be a sheep or a human, and that's why you can pick them up from around the local area here, because we do have sheep that are around here. There's only one intermediate host in the sheep liver fluke, and it's a plant. Okay, what happens is if the fecal material of sheep, say for example, contain the eggs of these organisms, and the fecal material gets into the water, what happens is the intermediate stage for this particular fluke is a plant called watercress. Any of you heard of watercress before? And so if you go and you collect watercress from around here and you eat it raw, your chances of getting a sheep liver fluke actually just shot sky high. Okay. If you cook the watercress, then you should be okay. But if you're like me, if I'm going to eat watercress, it's going to be raw, right? The cooked stuff kind of tastes like cooked cabbage to me. Yeah. That's real stuff. So. So if you go out and you collect your own watercress, you do increase your chances of getting a sheep liver fluke around here. Okay. Any questions about the flukes? This is a fluke that I got out of a beef liver here, a beef liver fluke. Any questions about the flukes? The last class within the phylum Platyhelminths that we want to talk about is the class Cestoda. The class Cestoda are sometimes what we call the tapeworms. Okay. Now, the tapeworms actually have some what we call evolutionary digressions. We're going to talk about those. So the class Cestoda are the tapeworms. This is a drawing of a tapeworm here, and normally when we think of evolution, what typically happens in the evolutionary process? We go from less complex to more complex, right? Sometimes organisms will have what we call evolutionary digressions. In other words, they take a step back from an evolutionary perspective, and that's kind of what has happened with the tapeworms. Typically, we see these evolutionary digressions in organisms when they are parasitic, okay? And all tapeworms are parasitic. Unlike the fluke, they do not have a complex life cycle. They have a more simple life cycle. All right. Unlike flukes, tapeworms can infect basically any vertebrate host, most tapeworms anyways. So you can actually get a tapeworm from your dog or your cat, or you can get one from a fish. You can get one from basically any other vertebrate organism. Okay. The tapeworms typically live in the digestive tract of the host. And so one thing that you do not see in the tapeworm body, if we look at the internal structures here, notice that there's no gastrovascular cavity. They don't have any digestive system at all. Why?
Isn't there any digestive when the host already?
Yeah, they don't need it. That's the answer, is they don't need one. Because they're living in the digestive tract, what are they using for food? Digested nutrients from the host. Does that make sense? Okay. So if they're in your digestive tract, they're absorbing nutrients that you have digested. And actually, individuals that get tapeworms, humans or other animals, one of the symptoms of tapeworms is that the individual starts to lose quite a bit of weight. Okay. Because that tapeworm is using a lot of the nutrients that are being digested by that organism. Okay. In fact, it's kind of interesting, in the 1960s, the new fad diet that all the ladies went on was to infect themselves with tapeworms. Okay. Probably not the best idea, because if you look in the head region up here, notice that there are some hooks up here, also some suckers. The top sucker is what we call the rostellum. But those hooks and suckers allow these tapeworms to attach to the into the small intestine of the digestive tract. And they can actually, those hooks and suckers can actually cause ulcerations in the small intestine, which is basically cuts in the small intestine, and that is not a good thing, okay, to have. Notice that we don't really call this a cephalic region anymore. It actually has its own name. It's called a scolex, okay? And the scolex is a head-like structure. But the reason why we don't consider it a true cephalic region is because there are really no sensory structures associated with the scolex. Basically, all the scolex has are the suckers, the hooks, and then the top sucker called the rostellum. Okay, and the only function of that scolex is to help the tapeworm attach to the digestive system of the host. All right. Now, posterior or behind the scolex, we see these repeating units, and each of these little segment-like structures are what we call proglottids. And basically what a proglottid is it's a reproductive machine. Okay. Notice inside of the proglottid we have both ovaries and testes. Reproduction in these organisms usually occurs hermaphroditically. Once the reproduction has occurred, maturation occurs more posterior. So when they produce a new proglottid, it's produced right by the scolex. So these proglottids back here more posteriorly are the older proglottids, and they can be filled with eggs, sometimes hundreds of thousands of eggs per proglottid. Eventually, what's going to happen is these proglottids are going to mature, or what we call become gravid, and they'll eventually release from the rest of the worm, and then the eggs are released out with the fecal material of the host. If the fecal material, or those larvae that, I should say that the eggs that are inside of those proglottids will eventually hatch, and those larvae can actually get up on a blade of grass or something, so that if another host comes along and eats that grass, they'll become infected with the tapeworm. Okay. Any questions about that? Yeah.
So is it common among cattle to be infected with these?
It is. Pretty much all animals. Very rarely do you find wild or even domesticated animals that don't have some tapeworms in them. Some animals are more susceptible than others. For example, predators typically have more tapeworms than herbivores. Okay, so like cats and dogs typically have a lot of tapeworms. Sometimes these tapeworms can actually get very, very large. I've seen tapeworms that are about an inch wide. Okay, the proglottids are about an inch wide. I've seen tapeworms that are as long as 50 meters long. Okay, so they can get quite long. If you have more than one tapeworm in you, you can have some fairly severe weight loss problems. The reason why predators are more susceptible to getting tapeworms is because if a predator eats an animal that has a tapeworm and eats their digestive tract, they can actually get that tapeworm directly from the animal. Does that make sense? It's not that uncommon for dogs and cats to have tapeworms. And if you have a dog or a cat, you ought to deworm your dog or your cat probably about once every 6 months. Okay. Even if they're inside animals, if you let them outside at all, you need to deworm them. Okay. If your dog or cat's anything like my dog, the minute I let her go, she's found a dead animal within 2 minutes. She's chewing on, right? Okay. It's very important that you do that. And the reason why is tapeworms can be passed from your dog or your cat to you or to your kids. And they can be very serious problems in young kids. If you have a tapeworm, you can actually just take medication, kind of like what you would give your dog or your cat, and get rid of them. But again, ulcerations in the small intestine can occur, which can cause long-term problems. Yeah?
How do you get rid of your dog or cat?
Basically, what happens is your dog or your cat, no matter how clean you think they are, they're actually not that clean. So when they defecate, pieces of their fecal material and maybe pieces of eggs and so forth will get caught in the hair, and their hair. And then when you pet them, It can get on your hands or underneath your fingernails. If you don't wash your hands, it can get into your digestive tract. Okay. Now, or if you, most of you have done this before with your dog or cat, maybe you still do. If you get your dog or cat and put your face in their fur, you can pick them up that way. Okay. As I talked about this with, did I tell you about telling elementary school kids about parasites? Mm-mm. I talk I go down to Ephraim Elementary quite a bit and give little presentations on different animals and stuff. One of the presentations I give them is on parasites that they need to be careful of. You know, and I tell them, you know, one of the most important things you can do all the time is when you get in from outdoors, wash your hands, and that will help to keep you from getting parasites. And I showed this bottle of a tapeworm and some other parasites. And right while I was talking, this one little boy jumps up, runs to the back of the room, and the teacher's, you know, trying to catch him. I mean, he just takes off full speed back there. Man, he has, you know, he's like filthy from recess. Man, he has that water on, he has the soap going. He had to watch right then. He didn't want any of these organisms in there. So, but basically, deworming your dogs and cats is pretty easy. You can either take them to a vet, or if you're cheap like me, you can go down to IFA and buy a little syringe. It's kind of like toothpaste, and they have these little syringes. You just grab your dog or your cat and open their mouth, shove it down their throat, push the plunger. And, if you own horses, one of the main things that they will do for horses is they deworm them quite commonly. Even domesticated cattle and sheep operators deworm their cows and sheep. So they are quite common. Okay. Kind of interesting, I did warn my dog one time, and say she's starting to lose a little bit of weight, and sure enough, about 2 hours later, she defecates right out in front of our front porch. You know how dogs are once in a while. Usually she doesn't do that. But as I was kind of cussing her out for, you know, defecating off our front porch, I noticed that in her fecal material, there was something moving. So I kind of looked a little bit closer. And it was a tapeworm about that long. It was squirming around in the fecal material, which is kind of cool. My wife wouldn't let me take a picture of it. She said that was two girls. I thought it was pretty cool. But here's a tapeworm. You can see the scolex here. There are proglottids running more posterior, and this is even part of the tapeworm here, more posteriorly. Notice as you get more posterior, the proglottids get larger because they're filling with eggs and so forth. Yeah.
So when you deworm an animal, what is the process, the chemical reaction, or what is it you put in that makes the worm either?
The chemical that they put in actually just makes the worm detach from the digestive tract is essentially what it does. So, yeah.
We used to, well, still do sometimes, deworm our cattle with chewing tobacco. Does that really work, or is that just a myth? What causes that to actually work?
The answer is it doesn't work very well.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it just doesn't work very well. Okay. Some people try and deworm things with alcohol. It does work to some extent, but not as well as the medications. This is just a close-up view of the scolex. You can see the rostellum here, the hooks, and the suckers on the scolex. This is looking more posteriorly at some proglottids. These are the ovaries right here, and these kind of lighter, darker spots, I guess you could say, are the testes in the proglottid. Okay, any questions about the phylum Platyhelminthes? The next phylum then that we want to talk about is the phylum Nematoda. The phylum Nematoda are sometimes what we call the roundworms. Now, when we say roundworms, we're not talking about earthworms. Okay, most of you, when you think of a worm, you think of a nightcrawler, right? These are not nightcrawlers. We'll actually talk about the earthworms and their allies a little bit later on this semester. But nematodes are sometimes what we call the roundworms. The nematodes are bilaterally symmetric. They are triploblastic, but they are pseudocoelomate. This is the only pseudocoelomate phylum that we're going to talk about. Okay. The nematodes, some of them are parasitic. and some of them are free living. Okay, there are actually quite a few nematodes that live in the soil. In the soil, in a good fertile shovel full of garden soil, there may be as many in just one shovel full. There may be as many as 100,000 nematodes in just one shovel full of soil. Okay, so they're microscopic. Even in very unfertile soil, as I've tested unfertile soil around here with my, I used to teach soils here, and you can extract nematodes out of the soil using techniques. And even in very unfertile soil, you'll have, a handful of soil that big, you can get two or three nematodes out of it typically, even in unfertile soil. Okay. So there are a lot of free living nematodes, and those nematodes that live in the soil, they're not going to cause you any problems. They are not parasitic. Some scientists believe that the nematodes are the most numerous animals on the face of the earth because there are so many soil nematodes. Okay. There are also some parasitic nematodes, and we're going to talk about some of those parasitic nematodes a little bit later on. Okay. Any questions about the just general characteristics? Now we'll see some major differences between the nematodes and the platyhelminth worms. First of all, they're pseudocoelomate. Notice that they do have a cephalic region, however, their cephalic region, they don't have a lot of sensory structures, and their brain, again, is very, very primitive. They do have some nerve cords, but again, they're not like our nerve cords. They're just simply to move information back and forth. They're more like our neurons in our arms or in our fingers. Okay. One big evolutionary difference is that they have, look here, a mouth. And notice what we have over here, a cloaca or an anus. So they have a complete digestive tract, okay, with a mouth and an anus. So this is a big evolutionary advance in the nematode worms. However, you'll notice in this digestive tract that they don't have a lot of specialization. You don't really see a stomach or small intestine or large intestine or anything like that, okay? And that's because there's really not a lot of modification in the digestive tract. It's pretty much what we sometimes call a straight shot gut. Okay, in other words, the food goes in the mouth, goes straight through the gut and out the anus. It's more efficient than a gastrovascular cavity, but it's not as efficient as guts with specializations like stomachs, small intestines, those types of things. Okay, but it is more efficient than the gastrovascular cavity. Respiration in these organisms occurs by simple diffusion, again. Notice they typically have a cuticle, which is an acellular layer that surrounds the worm, kind of like the cuticle in a leaf. This helps to protect the worm from digestion and the immune system of hosts when they are parasitic. When they're in the soil, this cuticle helps to prevent them from getting scratched up and kind of sandpapered to death by soil particles. Okay. Another big difference between the nematode worms and the platyhelminth worms is notice in this picture you just see a testes with the seminal vesicle which contains the sperm. So in the nematode worms, they have separate sexes. And therefore, the only way that nematode worms can reproduce is by sexual reproduction, okay? Which is a little bit different than the platyhelminth worms. Any questions about that? Another big difference is their muscular system. They don't have any segmentation, but they only have longitudinal muscles, which means the muscles run the entire length of the body. Because they don't really have any circular muscles or any antagonistic muscles to those longitudinal muscles, what happens is when they move, they can't really move from point A to point B. They just kind of wiggle back and forth and kind of move using wiggling action. But, you know, like if I want to go to that overhead projector, I can walk straight to the overhead projector, right? I can direct my movement. If you were to put a nematode worm here on the desktop, and there was some food right over here, it may or may not get there. It just kind of undulate and wiggle. Okay, does that make sense? Yeah.
I've heard before that if you pull a worm in two, it still lives. Is that true?
The answer is yes, but those are segmented worms, not roundworms. Okay, those are not nematodes. We'll talk about that here in a couple of days. Any other questions about structures of the nematode? Again, remember that they are pseudocoelomates, so they have an independently functioning digestive system, but no other independently functioning organ systems. Okay. This is a picture of some nematodes here. This is one that's called a hookworm. Schistosomiasis can be caused by this. The horsehair worms belong to this group of organisms. This is a horsehair worm that's emerging from a spider. The horsehair worms, they are not parasites of humans, but they're parasites on arthropods, which include spiders, grasshoppers, and so forth. And what they do is they mature inside of the grasshopper or spider. Then when they get near water, they'll actually, most of the time, kill their host, emerge, get into the water where they can mate. The reason why they're called horsehair worms is they're typically a little bit darker colored than this one here, and you'll see them sometimes in water troughs or in ponds. And the wives' tale is that the hair off the mane or the tail of a horse, if it gets into the water, it can come alive. Have any of you heard that before? Actually, that's not true, but that's kind of what they look like. They look like the hair off of a horse's mane or a horse's tail, therefore the name horsehair worms. Okay. I want to talk about a few different species of nematode parasitic worms. Some of them I'm going to talk about in a little bit more detail than others. Dyrophilaria mitis is called heartworm. Typically that infects predators such as dogs and cats. It can get into the circulatory system of the host, and it attacks and feeds on the valves of the heart, and so it can cause heart failure. This is another parasite that you should have your pet immunized against, or get medication for this one periodically. The Trichinella spiralis and the Ascaris lumbricoides. The Ascaris lumbricoides are what we call the intestinal roundworms. The Trichinella spiralis are the pork worms. They actually have a little bit different effects on our bodies. The Ascaris lumbricoides actually gets into our digestive tract and can cause some intestinal problems. Trichinella spiralis can actually get into our muscle and can cause some autoimmune-like diseases. The symptoms, I should say, are kind of like autoimmune diseases. The symptoms of Trichinella are very similar to MS, and it can cause death in the host. Okay, both of those types of worms you get by eating poorly cooked or uncooked pork. Okay, you probably heard that when you eat pork products such as bacon, pork chops, etc., you need to cook them well, right? Don't eat them undercooked. And one of the main reasons why is because pork have a lot of parasites, especially roundworm parasites, that you can pick up by eating their uncooked or poorly cooked flesh. Okay? Any questions about that? The next one I want to talk just a little bit about is Enterobius vermicularis, which is the pinworm. And that'll be the last one we'll talk about. We'll come back and talk about the hookworm and the Wuchereria, the filaria worms. But pinworms are actually fairly common in the human population. We see outbreaks of pinworms in elementary schools many times, or in daycare centers. And the reason why is because in those areas, one, children have a lot more intimate contact than adults. We've talked about that before, right? And not only that, but children typically are not as sanitary as adults. And what happens is this particular worm lives in the large intestine of the adult, can be a human, right? Or in the large intestine of the host, which can be a human, I should say. What happens is when the reproduction occurs in the large intestine, it usually occurs when the host organism is at rest, okay? And that's usually when you're sleeping. Once the female is fertilized, she will actually migrate out of the anal opening, and she'll lay her eggs around the opening of the anus. Okay, and when she lays those eggs there, they hatch very, very quickly. The young actually have a little pin-like structure on the end of their tails, and they actually attach to that soft tissue around the opening around the anus. All of you know what I'm talking about, right? Then in the morning when the host gets up, they have an itch, okay? And so they itch themselves, and those larvae then can get underneath the fingernails of the host. And of course, if that host does not wash their hands properly, then they can reinfect themselves or other individuals. So next time when you get up, and you know, this is a disease. Next time you get up and you have an itch in the morning, be sure you wash your hands fairly well afterwards so that you don't reinfect yourself with your own pinworms. Or, you know, if you're with somebody else, husband, wife, etc., you know, make sure you're not sucking on their fingers before they wash their hands after they itch during the morning, right? Pinworms typically do not affect adult humans very much. And the reason why is our bodies are just so large. They typically have larger effects on children because children's bodies are just not as large as our bodies, and we can't deal with them.